So I'm going to talk about some work that was done over the last year or so with Maxime and with Brian, and maybe this sort of title of novel signatures for direct detection. Maybe novel is a somewhat fancy way of putting it, novel or exotic, but also say crazy, unlikely. Well, unlikely. It's one of the points here, I guess, is, you know, how do you define what's unlikely? Our basic idea is just trying to think about expanding the parameter space a little bit. And of course, we heard a lot of motivations for doing that yesterday. So in some sense, some of the one of the models I'll look at is motivated by issues which are related to indirect detection. And then thinking about how this would impact on direct detection experiments. So just to... This is the old version of my talk. Never mind. Okay, so just to set the scene, you know, what do we know about dark matter? Well, the first approximation, absolutely nothing, other than that it has some gravitational interaction. The minimal sort of assumption that people like to make is that it's a thermal relic, and that gives us an annihilation cross-section at the time of freeze-out of about 1 picobar. But of course, there are a number of other handles we'd like to have. We'd like to know what the annihilation signal is in the galaxy. It's determining prospect redirect detection. We'd like to know what the scattering cross-section is on the thermal bath of the early universe, because that determines how cold it is. The cold dark matter, the structure of the plane, and so on. So this is an important constraint at that time. And we'd also like to know, obviously, the direct detection, what the scattering rate is on whatever is in the detector, say, on UPI. Or nucleons. Now, if in a minimal model, of course, all of these things tend to be correlated because they're determined by the same physics. So you might ask, well, minimality might be a good way of proceeding, but what about if you try to expand things a little bit? Well, are there good motivations for doing that? Well, one of them is simply to try and understand what the experimental sensitivity really is. What do we have the prospect of actually being able to see? That's one aspect. Another one, of course, is this issue that if you start to decouple some of these different handles on dark matter, you have the prospect of maybe enhancing some things, suppressing other ones, and you can get interesting signatures like that. So, for example, of course, yesterday we heard about the fact that a number of the indirect observations require larger cross-sections for larger cross-sections here. And so you might want to worry, or you might want to think about enhancing this, but maybe you may have a problem if you similarly enhance the scattering rate. So in that sense, we're trying to enlarge the parameter space. Okay, so I'm going to focus for this talk just on this issue of direct detection, but this is sort of what's behind thinking about things in this way. So this is the current constraint plot. We saw a version of this morning. This is CDMS and V0.10. And what's important really is that this is a very strong constraint already, right? This is per-nucleon cross-section 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8 picobar. So it's not a weak rate, in fact. We talk about WIMPs, but it's well below a WIMP cross-section. All of these models in supersymmetry have other suppression factors, so I tend to think of it as normal, but it is a small rate. And so that's a non-trivial constraint to think about when you're starting to play with annihilation cross-sections which are enhanced by factors of 100 or 1,000, something like that. So as we know, dark matter should be dark, so you don't want large couplings to vectorial-type currents, often with axial currents. Even at loop level, these things tend to be strongly constrained. So that's on one side. Yet, as I said, on the other side, you have this motivation for thinking about larger or enhancing rates for indirect detection. So to do that, generically, you want some WIMP state which is charged. That's how you get Sommerfeld enhancement, for example. So there's a bit of a tension between these two sort of motives, experimental or phenomenological motives. And so what I want to do in this talk is sort of think about the transition between them. So you can think about a charged state like this. But we can also start to split it. So I can split it and say into two neutral states, or maybe a neutral state, which is the WIMP, and an excited state, which is charged. And then you do have couplings to vectorial currents, but they're off diagonal. So this is basically the inelastic dark matter scenario to neutral states here. And here I have a coupling to the electromagnetic current. Here I, for example, could have a coupling to a current in the dark sector. So that's what I'm going to do in this talk. I want to consider those two cases separately. So the first one, we'll talk about split neutral states. Well, neutral in terms of the standard model, they'll be charged under a dark gauge group because I want some vectorial structure to give enhancement for indirect, the indirect scatter, well, annihilation rate for indirect detection. That's one example, and then the second one is when we have decided charge states, and so there the vectorial coupling is to just weak current or electromagnetic current. Okay, so let's start with the neutral case. This is a model that we've seen already several times today. It's a very, if you like, a simple thing to do. Let's write down a sort of minimal dark sector. We have a U1 vector here. It's kinetically mixed with hypercharge or low energies just as a photon. And we don't want it to be massless for various reasons, so we'll add a dark Higgs sector just to break the pH symmetry. So Maxine already talked about this. This is going to be a slightly different regime, though, with a larger mass. So yeah, I guess about in 2007, we decided to look at Nima's model. Nima hadn't thought about it at the time, but anyway. This is basically the... this is old. This goes back to olden days, although he wasn't thinking about dark matter at the time. So we've got, in this case, if I allow a charge, or choose the charges of this Higgs appropriately, I can turn, or I can add a Wibb candidate, but I can give it two sets of masses, so a bare mass and the Higgs coupling, and then I can split the charge state into two neutral states. So this guy would be the Wibb, but this is going to be split by a small amount. So why is it split by a small amount? Well, as I said, I'm just trying to consider the transition between going from a charge case to when these things are split by a lot, and then I just have a singlet Wibb, and nothing interesting is going to happen. So I'm not going to try to explain why the splitting is small, it's just part of the parameter space. We can make this a thermal candidate, though. We roughly get a constraint on its the dark gauge coupling, or relation between the dark gauge coupling and the mass. For intents and purposes, for that calculation, the mass of these two are the same. And there's now this off-diagonal coupling between the dark vector field and these two states. They could be scalars. They could be Majorana fermions. So if you put them back together, you get a charge scalar or a Dirac fermion. It doesn't really matter too much. Okay, so a number of people have looked in more detail at models of this type, trying to think about what the natural parameters are here. So, for example, if this kinetic mixing comes, say, through integrating out some charge states at one loop, or some other coupling to charge states, you might think that this is roughly a one-loop factor. And in that case, there are ways of mediating, say, if you have supersymmetry in the visible sector, you can mediate the breaking to the U1 breaking, which gives you a rather GeV mass. A number of people have looked at that. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm just going to stick in numbers. But there are models that nicely explain this sort of mass scale. Okay, so for us, I'm going to fix this relation between the dark matter mass and the gauge coupling to give the thermal relic density. So it's a thermal Wibb. And that means that there are three parameters here that are relevant, the vector mass, the Higgs mass, which are going to be roughly of the same order, and the mixing parameter, kappa. Okay, so for direct scattering, what matters? Well, now there's only an off-diagonal vectorial current. So at first order, so we have transitions like this. It's sort of an electromagnetic transition, but you've got to do it through mixing, this kinetic mixing between the vector and the photon. So at first order, all you can do is, have an off-diagonal state here, so you can't actually elastically scatter at first order. But at second order, in this exchange, you can have elastic scattering, so you go through chi 1 to chi 2 and then back to chi 1 again. And so elastic scattering is second order, inelastic scattering is first order. So this case where I have to upscatter from the WIMP state to the excited state obviously takes some energy. You need to take the kinetic energy of the WIMP and use it to shift yourself up. So there's going to be a clear kinematic cutoff based on the fact that the kinetic energy of the WIMP is limited. Depending on the mass, maybe a couple of hundred keV. And so that needs energy. This is the inelastic dark matter scenario that was used a number of years ago now to try and reconcile the results from Dharma with the other experiments. What I'll emphasize here is that you do also have elastic scattering, and the constraints that you get in that way are not completely negligible. And there's also this interesting possibility of actually doing things the other way. If for some reason this Chi2 state survives from the early universe, decoupling and freeze out, then you could have the inverse here, where you actually downscatter. Chi2 hits the nucleus, downscatters, gives you some energy back. And so it's an exothermic process. And obviously, you get some energy out. So all of these, in principle, are possible. So somewhat more complex picture of the sorts of scattering interactions that can happen. OK, so the first case is just assuming the splitting is very small, so less than the kinetic energy of a WIMP in the halo. This is a first-order scattering process. What sort of constraints do you get? By the way, all the bounds here are going to come from CDMS, just because we had to pick one experiment. It tends to be the strongest at the moment. And this is what you find. So this solid line here is the case of no splitting. So say I have a Dirac WIMP candidate, no splitting at all, just the generic case. This is the mass of the vector in the dark sector. And you notice that if this guy is relatively light, this becomes an extremely strong constraint. So in this sense, this enhancement of annihilation in the galaxy, giving you a large or interesting indirect signature, is quite strongly constrained by direct scattering. That's just because, in this case, you do get a coupling to the vectorial current at one loop. There's a non-zero charge radius. And so you can see the sensitivity here is quite significant and well below that 10 to the minus 3 that you might think of as a natural one-loop value. OK, so then you can split the two states. Things get weaker. This is for 100 keV splitting. This is 150 keV. And if you go too far, of course, you don't have enough energy, kinetic energy in the WIMPs, to do the upscattering, and everything shuts off. And I think for these particular choice of values, normal halo velocity profile and so on, that happens at about 200 keV. So if you split things too much, or if you split them enough, then there's no constraint from this first order inelastic upscattering. Well, it's just kinetic energy, right? So it's B squared.
Yeah, but for some of these larger
velocities,
you must be sampling the tail
velocity. Sure. It depends how much you think you can play with how large the velocity is going to go, right? So, yeah, no, and that's what determines where this thing shuts off. So this is okay. So this is first order inelastic scattering, and as I said, this is in some sense not new, although the particular model we're using is slightly different in the sense that it was motivated by issues of indirect detection. Okay, so that's inelastic scattering. For elastic scattering, as I said, this is now a second order process. So I can take, rather the splitting here can be much, much larger. There's no kinematic constraint anymore. It's just normal elastic scattering. The sensitivity is somewhat weaker. This is just the WIMP mass here. What's perhaps more interesting is to think about how the scattering actually proceeds. So there are sort of two regimes here, depending on what the mass of this mediator is relative to the characteristic nuclear radius. So how much of the nuclear structure do you probe? Obviously, it's very light, then you're basically scattering coherently off the nucleus. That's this regime here. You get strong sensitivity. If it's too heavy, then it just probes the structure of the nucleus, and things are somewhat weaker. Again, this is all for relatively large splittings. So just to emphasize that these constraints are still not negligible just through straightforward second-order elastic scattering.
Okay, so this is all work in the paper with Brian and Maxine. Okay, oops, go back. So that's inelastic upscattering and elastic scattering. What's also kind of interesting in this case is that you have this somewhat more complicated thermal history, or possibility for a more complicated thermal history, a little bit like Anne was talking about earlier on today. And you can ask, as these things freeze out in the early universe, what is the relic abundance of each of these two states? And of course, there's a little bit of model dependence in this, but you try to track it through, and basically what matters is what the annihilation rate is of these excited states into the WIMP states, down to the point of thermal decoupling. So it frees out, the mass difference is irrelevant, and so they're roughly, the abundance is equal, but of course there is a mass difference, and so at some point you can get a Boltzmann suppression. So to try and get a number here, or actually to minimize the number of these relic excited states, you can just take a unitarity bound for downscattering, 2-to-2 downscattering, and that's where this comes from. So the minimal amount is, for the parameters we're using, T star here is the thermal decoupling temperature, which, again, depends a little bit on the details of the model. So it could be determined by the mass of the vector. If you have efficient scattering with thermal bath, then it could go down to, say, twice the electron mass. Here, the fiducial value is about 10 MeV. Since the vector mass is not that much, we're not taking it terribly large. And then the minimal fraction here is maybe a few percent, something like that. So these things, in principle, can hang around a very long time, because if the mass splitting is very small, they find it very hard to decay. As Maxine mentioned this morning, for certain vector states, the vector can only decay. It can't decay to two vectors. It can only decay to three. This process proceeds via a vector. And so that calculation is actually embedded in this rate. That tends to be, for the parameters we're using, much longer than the age of the universe. It could also go through, I've talked about mixing with the photon, but it's really mixing with hypercharge. So there's also a mixing with the Z, and so you can also decay to neutrinos. But that's also a very large, gives a very large lifetime. And so once you've got this relic ratio of the excited states, they tend to stick around, and so they should be around in the halo today. So this gives you the possibility of a very sort of novel signature in direct detection, where you have exothermic downscattering. So I should mention that there was also a paper by the, I hope I got the names right here, Harvard, Princeton, NYU group, about a week before us. Okay, so how does that actually look if we stick it on a plot? So here's a couple of lines, again, for particular fiducial values of the WIMP mass. So this is coming back to your question about velocity dependence. This is some assumed maximum escape velocity for the halo. A 1 GeV mass vector here, so relatively heavy. And this is the sort of first order constraint endothermic inelastic scattering that I talked about before. But now you get another line here, which is from this exothermic downscattering from the relic population of these excited states. And this is a band that would be the preferred Dharma region. Okay, so that's for one choice of parameters. Just remind you again, this line is quite strong, as I mentioned before, but it cuts off. It has a kinematic cutoff just because there isn't enough kinetic energy of the WIMPs in the halo. Whereas this one, of course, doesn't have the same constraint. So again, this is interesting just as a constraint plot, but perhaps even more interesting is the fact that it would give you a rather unusual looking signature because of the extra energy deposition. Okay, this is the same thing, just for a much heavier mass of the WIMP. The mass dependence feeds in a number of places, and then we're using it to fix a number of the couplings. It also determines the point of thermal decoupling, which feeds into this as well. So for heavier WIMPs, it turns out to be somewhat more constraining. Okay, so that's one example where we had these neutral, split neutral states. And as, you know, just to emphasize that the constraints even now are non-trivial, even through normal elastic scattering. Let's consider perhaps an even weirder scenario where we have charged excited states. Same idea, relatively small splitting. I can now imagine turning on, this is a different model, right? So don't think of it as exactly the same as the previous one. I just have a neutral WIMP, some close nearby charged excited state. And we can imagine having either a weak current, off-diagonal weak current, or an off-diagonal electromagnetic current, and see what that does. So again, where does this number come from? Well, I'm just putting it in by hand, you know, various processes. If you imagine you had a symmetry originally, various processes might generate something similar at about one loop. Okay, now in this case, I'm not going to think about states that are going to live a long time. We're assuming these things decay pretty quickly, otherwise you'd run into problems with EBN. So for example, in the electromagnetic case, this thing will decay quite happily when it's free. Okay, so I guess one way of thinking about this is that it's not terribly exotic, depending on what you think exotic is. A number of people may have seen way too many of these sorts of plots. You tend to see less of them these days, which perhaps is a good thing. This is a particular supersymmetric scenario with universal mass parameters m0 and m1/2. And again, this issue that the we think of a WIMP as a very good dark matter candidate. If you look at it in a little more detail in these kinds of types of scenarios, it's not that easy to make it work, generally because the constraints push you to quite large masses. And so this is a few years old now, but this blue region is the region where you get the right relic density. And in particular, along here, it only works because you have extra processes that enhance the annihilation, so co-annihilation in this case, with a nearby charge state. So here you have a neutralino LSP and a charged style. Now, okay, I'm just giving this as an example. It's not, nothing particularly special about this model. Here the splitting doesn't have to be MeV. GeV is enough, but nonetheless, if you just happen to be sitting here, then you are in this regime. Okay, well, in that sense, not so exotic, but you do get very interesting things that can happen. If you make the splitting small enough, then these excited states, if they were around, could bind to nuclei. So we just did some calculations using some, you know, a couple of simple nuclear potential models, either a Gaussian model or a constant charge distribution, I should say. You tend to think of this Gaussian working well for lighter states. The constant one, that's what tends to saturate for heavier nuclei, and can just work out what the binding energy is. Electromagnetic interaction. And these are just some relevant elements here. Some of the lower ones, of course, are because they appear in direct detection experiments. And if you see the numbers, the real physical answer would be somewhere in between these two columns. The difference isn't too crucial, but they go up to about 20 MeV. So if the splitting is less than, say, 10 or 20 MeV, then you can have this possible binding process. And again, these are not, charge states are not going to be stable, but in a scattering process, if you have this possibility of binding, then it can happen in the interaction. So that's what's going to produce this sort of novel signature in this case. So there's sort of a couple of regimes here. If the splitting is very small, you can get binding to light elements. We'll see that can be quite constrained. If the splitting is a bit larger, you can get recombination with heavier elements, say the ones in direct detection experiments. It turns out that's not as constrained as you might think. And of course, if the splitting is heavier still, you don't get binding, but you can still get resonant enhancements or loop-induced enhancements, which I won't talk about too much. But this can go up until, you know, you get to the kind of scale of the WIMP momentum in the halo. Okay, so here are a couple of examples for those two types of currents. This is a charged weak current. Imagine your WIMP coming in. Here's a nucleon in the detector. there's a weak charge current process here where you produce the excited state, and you can do it just because of the fact that this is now bound and you have some binding energy to use. Now this thing will produce this bound state. It may, of course, generally produce it in some kind of excited state, and then, depending on the energy gap, throw off some extra energy. So you could have quite an energetic event. That's a weak current capture. We could also have an electromagnetic process where you bind by throwing out a positron, again producing this bound state. So as I said, those binding energies are order MeV. So if you play around with the mass splitting, you can get this kind of energy scale released in the scattering process, which is, of course, you know, completely different order of magnitude to the normal recoil energy scale that people are looking at. Sorry? It's going to depend a little bit, so that's what I'm going to talk about now. It's going to depend a little bit on what kind of process it is, how this energy is distributed. But it could be, in the electromagnetic case, you produce this positron, which will do what positrons do and try to give you some gammas. In the weak case, you could also have extra neutrons thrown out from some excited state of this bound state. I mean, I don't know in great detail, but this is in more detail now for the weak current capture. If you produce this bound state, it's going to be excited, and it'll decay depending on the details of exactly what the nucleus was. As I said, you might throw out gammas, neutrons, generic. Again, it's going to depend exactly what this nucleus state is and how it likes to decay. So to make an estimate of this, it's a resonant process, right? This is basically scattering like this, and then the final state involves this bound state. Generically, this entrance width is going to be the smallest one, and so that'll determine the total cross-section. You can estimate these things. It turns out, you might think this is going to be very large, assuming this coupling is normal, weak scale type coupling. The per nucleon cross-section is, not so big, around the normal constraint on the elastic scattering cross-section. But of course, the signature would look completely different. I should say, this is really, this is a coherent process, so I'm just converting it to the normal benchmark for nucleon cross-section. So this is just an estimate, but that's the way that the transition would work. As I said, sort of coming back to your question, I don't know exactly what it would look like. But you produce an excited state, it's going to want to kick off certainly gammas, maybe neutrons, but that depends on exactly what the, which element it is. So that's the weak process. In the electromagnetic case, this is not really a resonant process anymore, but again, it's forming a bound state, so you can estimate it from the parton level width and the overlap of the scattering and bound state wave functions. So this calculation can be done perhaps a little more precisely. It's complicated, though, because you have the scattering and you produce this positron in the middle of the nucleus, and it has to tunnel out. So there's a gamma suppression factor, which is also a little bit tricky to handle because it'll be a relativistic positron. So you have a relativistic gamma factor, which we tried to, estimate. And it gives you a suppression, but maybe not as large as in the generic non-relativistic case. And so if you just plug in generic parameters, this could be extremely large in principle, again, for some characteristic values of the masses and weak scale values of the coupling. And so in this case, the signature is maybe a little bit clearer. You're going to produce this positron. Okay, here the assumption was you have capture to the ground state, which doesn't have to be the case. It can also be to some excited level and then decay. But the crucial thing, the simplest thing to say in general is that the amount of energy which is being deposited during the interaction is very large. So maybe generically these things are going to look like gamma type events, right? So they're going to look far more like background like events than they are nuclear recoils. Okay, so you might be thinking that this should be ruled out by some searches for rare isotopes. It turns out they're not quite as constraining as you might think. The strongest constraints are actually for heavy hydrogen, but that requires a very, very small splitting, and so in our case, this is not going to be relevant. The next best ones are for the anomalous abundance of heavy versions of carbon. And so that would be relevant here because you could bind to nitrogen. And this requires a fractional abundance of 1 part in 10 to the 20, which sounds pretty good. But of course, to bind to nitrogen, you need the splitting to be pretty small. So that's this sort of window of 0 to 4 MeV. And so, yeah, if this is possible, then you do get a strong constraint. However, for the weak current capture, it's actually impossible just because the nuclear, the table or the plot of binding energies doesn't allow you to do this. And so in that case, you don't get a constraint at all. For the electromagnetic capture, then this does give you a constraint, provided splitting is less than, as I said, 4 to 5 MeV. So if the splitting is larger than 5 MeV, but less than 20, there isn't really a strong constraint from these sort of anomalous isotope searches. So it's different to charged dark matter in that sense, where you do have strong constraints. I'll just mention quickly, once you have things like this, you can also have indirect signatures as well through resonant annihilation. So this is the same model with the weak charge current. Now, annihilation of two WIMPs, conforming this sort of Wimponium bound state. In this case, it's a scalar, and so it can decay to monochromatic gammas, and so that would be, in principle, fairly easy to see, and that would give you constraints on the coupling, but of course it depends what kind of bound state you perform. In terms of neutrino signatures, in fact, you wouldn't expect to see anything because there's enough iron in the sun that if the splitting is small enough, say less than about 10 or 11 MeV, you'll more easily bind these things to iron than you will annihilate to produce neutrinos. And so most of this stuff, if it was captured in the sun, wouldn't be able to annihilate. It'd be stuck in these bound states. So this is a better signature, indirect signature, than this one for things like this. Okay, so I think I've come to the end. So as I said, novel or maybe crazy signatures, but these are the sorts of things that you can think about when you start playing with the parameter space. As I said, it could be motivated just by thinking about what the experimental reach is, but also these days by thinking about enhancements in astrophysical signatures. So I talked about neutral excited states. So this is a version of inelastic dark matter, I guess, where you also have the possibility for exothermic signatures. And also these charged excited states, where you have the possibility of forming bound states and scattering, which is perhaps not as constrained as you might think. I also didn't talk about it, but if the splitting is even larger, so getting above of order a GeV, say, which perhaps might be more natural, then you do get further enhancements, although none of them, these are sort of resonant enhancements, but none of them are particularly large, at least in the models that we looked at. And welcome to think about other possible signatures of this, or maybe there are ways of ruled out. I think we're heading into the discussion session now, so if anyone can think of an interesting signature, I'll just mention one. I think Victor Flambaum pointed out that what you could do when you have these heavy charged states sitting in nuclei, you could actually stabilize high Z nuclei much higher than the stable ones that actually exist now. I don't know what the limits are on those, but in principle, that's also possible. Okay, thanks very much.
I'm not sure if I understand what you're saying. You say, well, in this model with the charged particles that would be quasi-stable.
No, they're stable.
Stable, yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I can always go back to the neutral state, but. Yeah, okay. So, well, I mean, why have interaction? Okay, but they don't decay. That's the point.
They don't decay. That's right.
How can we not have seen them if they are there in any I mean, charged particles cannot avoid being detected, I guess.
There are no charged particles floating around, right? If they're free, they decay very quickly. They only exist through the scattering interaction. So the only way directly to see them is to find these weird anomalous bound states. That's the only place where you would see them now.
And the bindings are in the order of tens of MeV, and the mass splitting is 5 MeV. So and when you get into quantum state, the binding only powers the instability. So then you have infinite.
Yeah, I mean, they won't decay, they're stable. You could kind of throw them together and try and split it apart, but they won't decay. So you need a way of identifying anomalous isotopes of particular elements.
I mean, it's the same thing as neutron decays to proton, right? But you combine it with the proton and then there's a case.
Elaborate a little bit more. What do you mean anomalous isotope?
Well, you've got a very heavy, in principle, a very heavy charge state sitting inside.
Very heavy means, give me some.
Well, it's a wing, right? So it could be 100 GeV, it could be a TeV. Sitting inside a nucleus. Say it's in germanium, for example, we're talking, the WIMP is much heavier than the germanium nucleus, right? But it's just sitting in the middle. And so it changes the principle little. In this case, I was talking about binding, say, to nitrogen. So it changes the charge and changes the chemistry. So it looks like a carbon nucleus, but it's very, very heavy because it has this extra WIMP sitting inside it.
That's why
I was talking about these bounds. So you can ask, people look for anomalous heavy isotopes of particular elements. And they shouldn't be sitting around.
In the 80s, there was a several campaign in the 80s to look for this kind of new band.
Yeah, so I tried to, as I said, we tried to find all of the constraints that existed. Here we are. And the thing is, most of the constraints, because they were particularly looking for things like charged dark matter, where you don't have to worry about the splitting, most of the constraints are for light nuclei. It's easier, right? They're often in gaseous form or liquid form. Yeah. Whereas here, if you make the splitting, as I said, more than 4 or 5 MeV, you won't bind to anything lighter than, say, iron or something like that. And there are constraints on anomalous isotopes of gold. I think that's one of the heavier ones. But they're not really competitive in this range, so you don't get a stringent constraint. Yeah, sure, in principle you can go out and look for it. Rule it out that way. But we don't know it or not. Interesting to know if there's another way to constrain these things. I said it's crazy, but you'd like to know that it's not possible.
The binding itself would be electromagnetic.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's why it's bound, right? It's just electromagnetic capture. I should mention that in the case of charge currents, not all binding is possible through the scattering because you also have the change in the nuclear binding energy. So for certain elements, if you do this scattering, you won't be able to get into the bound state because the binding energy for the correspond because you're flipping a proton to a neutron, vice versa. So you won't actually be able to do it in that case, in certain cases.
So, sir, do you need to be heavier than iron, I guess iron 56 or whatever, to have this work?
Heavier
nucleus, when you say heavier than iron, is that?
Oh, no, okay, that was just actually, it's less than that. I think binding for iron needs about less than 10 MeV, and this is somewhat weaker than that. It's basically, the strongest constraints only go up about this far, so.
So you could form one of these things on argon?
Yeah.
And that's, how long would your bound state last?
Well, it won't decay because it's just electromagnetically bound. It's like an atom.
But then, wouldn't you expect such effect to be in all elements?
Well, you could
have a consistent way. Wouldn't you expect some consistent contribution for all? Or would you have to?
Well, as I said, it'll only bind if the splitting is less than the binding energy. Right, so it's going to be easier to bind with heavier elements than lighter ones.
Okay.
If you're assuming.
But it should be at least consistent, right?
Yeah, I mean, to get these sort of constraints here, we're just assuming that you have exposure over the age of the universe, given some generic number density for WIMPs. I mean, there aren't that many WIMPs, right? So the cross section is small, and so you don't necessarily expect to have, large fractions of these things in an anomalous form.
But at least you should be able to get some. The limit then would be.
Well, these are the as I said, if you try to go to heavier elements and you look for what the limits are, they're not very strong. Because we already, as I said, I did a calculation for the cross-section. So I can work out what the fractional abundance is. And it's well below the limits that exist for most of them, well, all the heavier elements. In, as I said, in the case of carbon, this is non-trivial, and then you're ruled out. So that's why, as I said, if it captures electromagnetically and the splitting is less than 4 or 5 MeV, then you're ruled out by this constraint. So as I said, if you can do the same kind of analysis for all the heavier elements, then yeah, you can kill it, which is fine. As I said, it's a crazy model.
In the early universe, don't you expect a fair amount of co-annihilations between the charged chi2 plus minus and chi1, and so what are the limits on the mass?
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't, the splitting, once you're less than about a 20th of the mass, it doesn't really change it. It's like a threshold. Once you get the splitting below that, co-annihilation works, and then it's the same.
So in that case, then, the chi plus, the chi2 minus is going to annihilate with the chi2 plus, no?
And then
you are going to have a large annihilation cross-section, and the omega density, the Rayleigh balance, will be quite small, no?
The WIMPs are not the charged states, right? The WIMPs are just the neutral ones. You will have co-annihilation, but it's just like in the MSSM. That's right, you have to work this out. Okay. But it's very much like living in this region here, where I have a neutralino and a near degenerate star, exactly like that. So it has co-annihilation, but you can still perfectly well get the bond of
relativity. That's
interesting.
Thank you.